The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners. I'm Eric Peabody, and this is the Horror Hill Podcast. Tonight's episode features two stories to get your skin a-crawlin', your hairs a-raisin', and your bones a-chillin'. Our first story is The Lost Lantern by Micah Edwards. In this tale, our unnamed narrator and his friend, Albie, are urban explorers and scavengers, sifting through everything from thrift stores to abandoned malls. But when they chance upon a lantern with a very strange power, it opens the door to realms better left unexplored. After that, we have Under Ken by Craig Groshek. Briarton is a normal small town, and the nearby St. Matthias Cemetery seems similarly unremarkable. However, local oddball Ken Klein died several weeks ago, and ever since being buried, people have reported seeing him moving around the cemetery after dark. Now, Pastor David Locklear is determined to get to the bottom of these strange occurrences, but he has no idea how literal that task will be. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Micah Edwards, I give you The Lost Lantern. It wasn't my fault that Albie went into the lost mine. I keep telling myself that. But I guess if I really believed it, I wouldn't have gone in after him. It was my fault that he had the lantern, after all. This all started as a search for uranium glass. Well, a little before that, I suppose. I met Albie on a bottle digging forum. He had found a really great dump site near me and was looking for someone else to come help dig it all up. I hadn't ever had the chance to talk about this hobby with anyone in person before, so I jumped at the opportunity. We spent the whole weekend rooting out bottles from the early 1900s and talking about other weirdo hobbies, as my dad always called them. By the end of the trip, we were fast friends. That was a couple of years back, but it helps explain who Albie was and why he would have gone into an abandoned mine on his own. He was lucky, you know. He could pick a random patch of mud and dig up some amazing treasure from 100 years ago. He was the kind of guy who got out of bad situations with nothing worse than a harrowing story. It made him a little bit reckless. I've never been particularly lucky. I mostly stick to the tamer weirdo hobbies. Albie was always trying to get me into urban exploration and sewer mapping and all that, but I liked the sort of discoveries that you could make with an open sky and a clear exit. He'd talk me into exploring an abandoned mall every once in a while, though, and in exchange, I'd drag him out to go comb through thrift stores for pieces of uranium glass, the old kitchen glassware that glows under a blacklight. To me, finding abandoned treasures in a thrift store was every bit as good as digging them up out of the ground. The stores rarely knew what they had, so if you had a blacklight and knew what you were looking at, you could pick up some amazingly rare stuff for just a few bucks. Plus, you'd see other niche collectors out there looking through the old posters or the salt and pepper shakers or whatever. I usually had no idea what exactly they were looking for, but I knew the look in their eyes. It was just like mine. We were on the hunt, tracking and stalking prey. The thrill was no less real just because our targets looked like unregarded kitsch. Albie, like I said, tolerated this more than he enjoyed it. He mainly used the time while I was shining my ultraviolet light over unsuspecting candlesticks to try to convince me to come on another crazy adventure with him. It worked about half of the time, so it was always worth his while to try, even if he didn't have a specific idea in mind. "Let's go back to the old Colosseum," he was saying that day. "I heard that someone got into the tunnels and they go all the way to the new arena. It was easier to keep digging out the old stuff than it was to tear up the ground again, so if you know where you are, you can pop up under the outfield where they store all the tarps." "Why would we want to do that?" I asked, shining my light over a stack of sadly unreactive glass plates. "I don't know, just to see them up close? You don't get the sense of scale when you're looking down at them from the stands. How big of a roll does it have to be to cover an entire baseball diamond?" I looked it up on my phone. "About 5,000 square feet." "Yeah, but that's just trivia. What does that look like? We could go see." "How long would it take us to walk through those tunnels to go look at some tarps?"
"As long as we go the right way? Half an hour, maybe."
"What are the odds we go the right way, Albie?"
"So an hour then, counting screw-ups. The tunnels themselves are going to have something cool, you know it."
"And then we have to get back."
"Hour and a half, then. We'll know the right way on the way back, so it'll be easier."
"I don't know." I did know, and so did he. I was going. The rest of this was just a formality.
"Come on, it'll be great!"
Albie was gracious in victory. He pointed to a bullseye lantern on a nearby shelf.
"Look, there's even a cool antique lantern you can... Whoa!"
His exclamation mirrored my own surprise. I had flashed the blacklight on the lantern, more or less by accident. I'd never heard of a lantern made with uranium glass. Nothing about the coloration in the panels suggested it would fluoresce, so there was no reason to have checked. It was lucky I did, though, because when the light hit it, the glass lens on the front of the lantern lit up brighter than anything I'd ever seen.
"Do that again," said Albie,
and I did. Sure enough, the round pane glowed a vibrant, eerie blue.
"That's fun, right? Ever seen anything like that?"
I had not, and at a price of $15, I couldn't take a chance at never seeing it again. I tucked the blacklight discreetly away, brought the lantern up to the front, and paid for it in cash. There was no reason to believe that the store would decide they'd made a mistake, nor that they'd have any recourse to come take it back. But it was better safe than sorry. This was my trophy. I wouldn't be losing it to anyone. Except Albie, it turned out. It was a half-hour ride back home, and he didn't put the lantern down for one second of it. It fascinated him.
"We've got to get some oil and check this out," he said. "You think it can shine blacklight? Could they have made something like that back then?
This doesn't say where it's from. Can you just shine regular light through some kind of fancy glass and see in UV? It was like that the whole way back. I fully expected him to ask if he could keep the lantern, but when I pulled up outside of his house, he put it down without an instant's hesitation.
"You've got to bring that thing to the arena tunnels," he said as he got out of the car. "I bet it looks awesome when that's the only light."
"Albie, man, take the lantern."
"Yeah? You sure?
You're super into it. Give me 15 bucks sometime and we're square."
"Oh man, thank you. I'm gonna have to go pick up some lamp oil. I'm taking this thing out tonight. Hey, if I find something cool with it, it's all yours. Like a uranium glass dump or something."
"I don't think you're gonna find a secret stash of uranium glass."
"I found a drone in the river once,
You never know. Just gotta keep your eyes open. I didn't think he was going to find anything. That wasn't really the point, though. The point was looking. Finding stuff was cool, but the joy was in the journey. Albie had an exciting new accessory for his journey, and that was all that really mattered. I was honestly shocked when I got a message from him later that evening. It was short, unexplanatory, and very much Albie.
You gotta come see this!
There was a map pin attached showing that Albie was out at the old quarry. I sighed and paused the TV show I was watching. What have you got? I sent back, as if I actually thought he'd just tell me. I hoped he would. I was settled in for the evening, and I didn't want to head back out just to see some weird rock that Albie had found.
Get here in 10 minutes, or I'm going in without you!
I dragged myself out of the chair, shaking my head. I knew this was going to be something minor. I knew I was going to regret not staying home. But I also knew that I had to go look. If it turned out that it really was something unique and amazing, I'd kick myself forever for not having hurried out to see it. Albie knew how to weaponize my FOMO. Grumbling, I pulled on a coat, grabbed my car keys, and drove out to the old quarry. It was locked up, of course, but only for those who didn't know where the holes in the fence were. Albie and I had been here a dozen times. I parked on the side of the road not far from the waypoint Albie had sent me and hiked on in. Two-dimensional coordinates are always a little bit iffy in a three-dimensional space like a mining pit. I made my way down the long, winding road to the bottom of the quarry, only to find that the map pin wanted me to keep going another few dozen feet into a solid stone wall. Albie was nowhere to be seen, of course. It had taken me 13 minutes to get there. He had undoubtedly grown bored of waiting and ducked into whatever tunnel he had found. Honestly, I'd be lucky if it turned out he was only 3 minutes ahead. It would have been entirely like him to send the text, decide I wouldn't make it in time, and set out on a solo exploration immediately. I swept my flashlight around, trying to figure out where he'd gone. Both in front and above, there was nothing but a blank wall. I could see no entrances of any kind. The GPS swore I needed to go into the stone, though. Frustrated, I turned my flashlight off, hoping that maybe I'd catch sight of a light shining out of a tunnel I'd missed before. It sort of worked. I did see a light. It wasn't in the cliff face, though, but instead tucked away beneath a tangled shrub growing at the base. It shone a deep, oceanic blue. My concern deepened as I crossed to the bush and pulled the lamp from its grasping arms. This was the lantern we had found in the thrift store earlier. It was lit now, the flickering orange flame inside turned to blues and purples by the tinted glass. There was no sign of Albie anywhere.
"Where are you?"
I called, turning in a slow circle. My voice echoed off of the quarry cliffs, but there was otherwise no response. I had no idea where he had gone. I had to be missing a cave somewhere. Suddenly, to my surprise, I spotted it. It was almost directly in front of me, a narrow, rectangular hole cut into the quarry wall. I couldn't imagine how I'd missed it before. It was thin for a quarry tunnel, but still at least 2 feet wide and definitely over 8 feet tall. It was located directly where Albie's map coordinates needed an opening to be. It didn't blend into the rock even a little bit. I must have been staring right at it before, but I had not seen it at all. I stepped forward, the lantern swinging loosely at my side. As the lantern light was occluded by my body, the narrow doorway vanished. I stopped. The lantern swung forward again. The pathway reappeared. I tried my regular flashlight, my phone light, and my small keychain UV light. Under all of their beams, there was nothing in front of me but a seamless rock wall. It blended perfectly with the rock around it. I could even put my hands on it and feel the solidity beneath them. When not under the scrutiny of the blue light from the lantern, the rock wall was solid and unbroken. When the lantern's light fell on it, though, the tunnel appeared again, in exactly the same place every time. I could reach inside. I could feel a cool, slow breeze coming from somewhere deep within. It felt like an expectant breath. I was afraid to go inside. "Albie," I called down the tunnel. "You okay? Why's the lantern out here? Do you need a light?" No answer. I could picture him discovering the same thing I had, the odd absence of the tunnel when the lantern wasn't lighting it. He would have been curious. He might have found a way in that I had not yet discovered. And once inside, he could have tripped in the dark, or hit his head, or suffered any of a number of debilitating injuries. I checked the oil level in the lantern. It was low, but adequate. I strobed the light back and forth across the wall a few times, watching the tunnel appear and disappear. Finally, I steadied the beam on the narrow entrance. "I'm coming in, Albie," I called. "You'd better actually be hurt." I thought it would be funny when I said it. It didn't sound that way once it was out of my mouth, though. The echoes hit my ears like a threat. The tunnel wound its way into the rock, twisting back and forth with no apparent reason to its construction. I could never see more than a dozen feet ahead before it would cut sharply to one side or the other. It wandered up and down as well. I was just thankful that it didn't branch at any point. It was small and claustrophobic, but at least my path back out was clear. Or so I thought, until I glanced back. I could feel the rock looming in all around me, which made sense as it was literally brushing my shoulders on either side as I walked. I could feel it tickling my back as well, which made no sense. That was the way I had just come. There couldn't possibly be rock behind me. There was, though. When I shone the lantern on it, there was nothing but an empty hallway. If I tried to simply step back without directing the light behind me, though, my shoulders collided immediately with a slab of stone that had the immovability of mountains. The rock reappeared immediately when it was not illuminated by the lantern. My circle of light was the only thing holding the unyielding stone at bay. Albie didn't have his light. However he'd gotten in here without it, it was seeming increasingly likely that he was trapped. I had to find him and get him back out. Even if he wasn't hurt, he was likely perilously low on air by now. "Albie?" I shouted. The echoes hurt my ears, but there was no other response. "I'm coming to get you, man. Stay put. Say something if you can." Nothing but silence. Mentally, I began figuring out how I could drag his unconscious body out while also keeping the lantern pointed forward. Maybe I could hang it around my neck? Or maybe I'd do better to get him up on my shoulders and keep the lantern in my hand. There wasn't really room to do a fireman's carry in here. But then again, there wasn't really room for much of anything that involved two bodies side by side. I was still trying to puzzle out the logistics when I turned another sharp corner and saw Albie fall. "Albie!" I called, rushing forward. He collapsed bonelessly to the ground, falling face down. He did not move. Until I grabbed his shoulder to roll him over, I genuinely thought that he was probably okay. I thought that I had gotten there just as he had fainted or run out of oxygen or something. As soon as I touched his body, though, even before I saw his face, I knew how wrong I was. Albie was flat, pressed like a flower between the pages of a book. He had no dimensionality left to him. His nose was crushed in on itself. His teeth were shattered and pancaked. His eyes were closed, which was for the best. I wouldn't have liked to have seen the pressed bone peeking through those sockets. He had been horribly crushed in the stone. I hadn't come around the corner just in time to see him fall. I had released him from his stone prison with the strange light from the thrifted lantern. When I removed the rock around Albie, his abused body had collapsed under its own weight. He had died the instant he had been caught here without the lantern. I had never had a chance to rescue him. I had only had a chance to trap myself. And it was a trap. I could feel that now. The tunnel up ahead went straight at last. The the lantern's blue light illuminating parallel walls stretching ahead and down until they vanished in the distance. I could feel eyes somewhere up ahead, beyond what the lantern could see, in the rock itself. They were watching me, as I knew they had watched Albie just minutes before. I took his flattened corpse by the hand. It was light, terrifyingly light. All of the liquid had been pressed out of it. I was going to carry him out. I wasn't going to leave him there. But then, just at the edge of vision in that long tunnel, I saw something move. Its head almost brushed the tall ceiling. Its thin torso moved easily through the narrow space. This corridor had been built for it, and things like it. It galloped toward me, and my nerve broke. I dropped Albie's broken hand, and I ran. The lantern swayed as I ran. The oil, already burning low, sloshed from side to side. The light danced crazily, inviting in shadows, creating unpredictable oscillations of rock. I bashed my head on an overhang that did not exist a moment later. I tripped and nearly fell on nothing at all. Eventually, I grabbed the lantern in both hands, ignoring the burning in my palms, and tucked it against my torso. It burned, but it kept a steady light forward. I would accept a few burns to avoid Albie's fate. I did not look back. I knew what was behind me. A blank rock wall, and somewhere within, or behind, or despite it, a creature that was more angles than were comfortable to see. Something crystalline and impossible, loping steadily along a pathway that did not exist. Something that had teased and taunted and trapped my friend, and then brought his lantern back outside to do the same to whoever came after him. To me. I did not consciously think any of this at the time. I only ran, the lantern burning against my arms and stomach, the light making reality dance and shiver before me. I did not think of what was behind. I did not even think of what lay ahead. I only ran. It was a shock when I spilled out into the quarry, into the cold night air that opened up for hundreds of feet in every direction. I made it 30 steps before I skidded to a halt, turned, and hurled the lantern back at that narrow passage where Albie had died, where I had so nearly lost my life. I couldn't have made that shot one time in 1,000, but that night, the lantern flew true, the corridor appearing and disappearing as the light tumbled end over end. The lantern sailed into that impossible mine and vanished. There was nothing but a solid rock wall remaining. I stood in the quarry for a long time, shaking. I don't know what I would have done if that stretched thing had emerged, but it never did. Eventually, my adrenaline drained away and my courage failed with it. I took one last shivering breath before I turned and fled the quarry. I haven't been back, of course, nor will I. I wish I had kept the lantern, though. There are so many blank walls in our world. I can't imagine that the thing from the quarry has only one unbranching corridor through which to travel. Somewhere in the depths, that pathway must have split, fractured into 1,000 unseen roads along which to travel. You've been listening to The Lost Lantern by Micah Edwards. Micah Edwards graduated from William & Mary with a degree in English and no particular plans to use it. He now finds himself occupying various roles as an author, a comedian, and a database administrator, depending on the day of the week. He resides in Richmond, Virginia, the world's premier home of authors named Micah Edwards. Next, here's Under Ken by Craig Groshek. Part 1. The first to see him were the teenagers. Midnight had come and gone, and the four of them, Darren, Luis, Angie, and Maddie, were still out, loitering around the back of the gas station, hyped up on stolen sips of cheap beer. Darren had been the one to suggest sneaking out. Luis had been the one to bring the beer. Angie and Maddie had just wanted to be anywhere but home. It had started as a dare. "Come on," Darren had grinned, half drunk and full of himself. "We go down to the cemetery, we take a few pictures, maybe a video, then we get out. That's it. Nobody'll even know." Maddie wasn't convinced.
"You mean besides the cops?" "Cops don't patrol near the cemetery," Luis scoffed. "Not since Ken died."
That was what finally made them go. The mention of Ken Klein, the reclusive old man who had spent most of his life holed up in a rotting shack at the edge of town. Rumors had always followed him. The residents of Briarton said he muttered to himself in strange languages, that he was part of some cult, that he would sit outside in the middle of the night and talk to someone who wasn't there. 2 weeks ago, he had died. A heart attack, they said. But now, people were saying something else. Something insane. "He's still walking around." Luis had laughed when he said it, but the words had stuck with them. Ken had been buried in St. Matthias Cemetery, just like everyone else. But every morning, the gravekeeper found his grave disturbed, as if someone had climbed out. It wasn't like they believed it, but they had to see for themselves. So now, here they were, standing at the gates to the empty cemetery, the air colder than it should have been for late summer, their collective beer buzz fading into something sharper. Angie clutched her phone, knuckles white, as she stared at the rows of old headstones, standing in solemn silence. Luis muttered something about how stupid it all was. Darren shushed them. And then, a noise, soft and muffled, broke the silence, the wet shuffle of something moving through the dirt. And then they saw movement near the farthest row, the dark shape of something rising from the earth. Maddie made a strangled noise, and Angie clapped a hand over her mouth. Darren took a step forward, whether to prove himself or to see better, none of them knew. But the moment his foot crunched on loose gravel, the thing turned toward them. The beam of Luis's flashlight caught it just enough to reveal a sunken, sagging face. Its skin, drawn tight over its bones, was tinged a sickly grayish white. Ken Klein. He moved with a slowness that should have been clumsy, but wasn't. His mouth moved, whispering something low and garbled, the words slipping through his teeth in a voice not his own. The teenagers ran. Darren, Luis, and Angie made it out first, vaulting the cemetery gate and stumbling into the road. Maddie was still behind them.
"Come on!" Darren hissed.
They turned, just in time to see Ken's corpse take a step toward her. Maddie didn't scream. She scrambled backward, clawing at the fence, and pulled herself over just as Luis yanked her the rest of the way. The four of them ran, without looking back. They never spoke of it again. The next morning, Pastor David Locklear arrived at St. Matthias Cemetery just after dawn. Ken's grave had been disturbed once more. The air was crisp, the sky tinged with soft pink and lavender as the sun began to rise over the hills. The town of Briarton was still waking up, but here, in the cemetery, it was deathly still. A few birds flitted between the trees, their chirping the only sound that broke the silence. David walked with steady purpose down the worn dirt path, past rows of old gravestones and the plots of those he had performed ceremonies for over the years. He had been the pastor of Knox Memorial Church for nearly a decade and had seen grief in all its forms, speaking the rites over young and old alike. But he had never seen anything like this. Ken Klein's grave lay at the farthest end of the cemetery, beyond the larger, more well-kept plots where the dead of the town's wealthier families rested. Ken had been buried in the section reserved for those without family, means, or visitors. A lonely grave for a lonely man. And yet, his resting place had not been left alone. David stopped at the edge of the grave. The dirt had been disturbed again. It wasn't the loose, crumbling earth of an old burial site settling. The soil looked as though it had been moved aside, not by a careless hand, but by someone or something climbing out. The gravekeeper, Jack Henshaw, was already there, kneeling in the dirt, cursing under his breath. His weathered hands worked a spade into the soil, trying to smooth out the mess.
"This is a fifth damn time," Jack muttered.
He spat into the dirt, looking up at David with tired, bloodshot eyes.
"I bury the bastard, and every morning it looks like he's been trying to escape."
David crouched beside him, brushing his fingers against the dirt. It was damp from the morning dew, but underneath, it was packed too tight for a fresh grave. If it had truly been exhumed each night, how had the dirt been replaced so perfectly every morning?
"Any idea who could be doing this?" David asked.
Jack let out a sharp bark of laughter.
"I mean, besides Ken himself?"
He shook his head.
"Kids, maybe. Or drunks, messing around. Hell, could be grave robbers for all I know. I'm not sure what old Ken had that was worth stealing."
David frowned. Grave robbers didn't dig people up just to put them back. Jack must have seen the doubt on his face, because he sighed and leaned on his spade.
"I don't know what you want me to say, Pastor. Every night this grave is fine. Every morning it looks like this. I never see anyone come in and I never see anyone leave. But people keep talking, whispering that Ken's still making the rounds after dark."
David's stomach tightened. He had heard the rumors too. "You don't really believe any of that, do you?" he asked. Jack fixed him with a flat stare.
"I believe I'm tired of shoveling dirt back into this damn hole."
David stood, dusting the soil from his hands.
"Thank you, Jack," he said, casting one last look at the grave before turning away.
That afternoon, he spent 2 hours in the church archives looking for any mention of Ken Klein, his family, his past, anything that might explain the strange events surrounding his burial. But Ken had left no real records, no next of kin, and no documented history except for a handful of property disputes and several unpaid utility bills. By nightfall, David had made up his mind. If Ken was truly rising from his grave each night, he needed to see it for himself.
Part 2. That evening, David sat alone in his truck, parked just outside the cemetery gates. The night was still and quiet. No wind, no crickets. Even the trees along the fence line stood motionless, their branches resembling blackened veins against the sky. The moon hung low, nearly full, casting shadows over the rows of graves beyond the fence. He checked his watch. 11:58 p.m., 2 minutes to midnight. He wasn't sure what he expected. A prankster, maybe, or perhaps some half-drunk kids with nothing better to do than stir up old ghost stories. He had even considered the possibility of wild animals disturbing the soil, but deep down, he knew none of those explanations made sense. Jack had filled in the grave again that morning. David had seen it himself. By morning, it would be disturbed again. If the stories were true, if Ken Klein really did climb from his grave each night, then David had to see it with his own eyes. A low, distant noise made him sit up straighter. It had come from the cemetery. He reached for his flashlight, gripping it tightly as he eased the truck door open. The cool night air wrapped around him, biting at the exposed skin of his hands and neck. He left the truck idling, the faint hum of the engine the only sound in the night, and stepped through the gates. The cemetery stretched before him in rows of weathered stones, some names long worn away. The older graves, those from the 1800s, leaned slightly, tilted with age and erosion. Further back, where the land dipped down toward the tree line, the newer graves sat in more uniform lines. Ken's grave was at the farthest edge, beyond the reach of the dim streetlights. David kept his steps light as he moved past the gravestones and old family plots. Then, he saw the dirt shift, He gripped the flashlight tighter. The ground over Ken's grave began to bulge upward. At first, it was subtle, like something settling beneath the earth. Then, the dirt split, crumbling at the edges, and a sickly, gray-skinned hand broke through, its mottled flesh stretched over stiff joints. A moment later, another hand followed. David stood paralyzed, unable to tear his eyes away, as Ken Klein pulled himself up from the grave. His movements were stiff, but purposeful. His hollow-eyed face emerged next, lips moving in a silent whisper. His neck twisted with a sickening crack, dirt spilling from his lips as he mouthed an indecipherable prayer. David stepped back, his mind screaming at him to run, but his feet stayed rooted in place. Meanwhile, Ken pulled himself free, dragging his legs from the grave until he stood fully upright in the moonlight. And then he turned, swiveling his head in David's direction. But his eyes, clouded and unfocused, did not see him. Ken turned away from David and began to walk, not toward town or his former residence, but somewhere else. David swallowed hard, steadied himself, and began to follow, at a distance. He needed to know where Ken was going. Ken moved strangely, not like a man in control of his own body, but not like the vacant, shuffling corpses of horror films either. Every step was deliberate, as if guided by some unseen force. He did not stumble or hesitate. His head stayed slightly bowed, his lips still moving, whispering words David couldn't hear. David adjusted his grip on the flashlight. He kept the beam low, allowing his eyes to adjust to the moonlight instead. If Ken noticed him, he gave no sign. The cemetery stretched around them in hushed stillness. Briarton was just beyond the hills, but felt impossibly far away. To David, there existed only the dirt, the graves, and the dead, and Ken walking among them. Ken moved past the gravestones, his bare feet sinking into the soft earth, clearly headed to a new destination. David's fingers twitched. He thought Ken might be wandering, looping in some undead routine. But then Ken changed direction and headed toward another grave. David slowed his steps. He didn't recognize the name on the headstone. It was a woman's grave, also recently disturbed. Ken stopped at the foot of the plot, raised his arms, and began chanting. David stiffened. He couldn't understand the words, but they were wrong, uneven. They scraped against his mind, slipping through his ears like something too vast, too ancient, to be understood. Then the ground shifted. David's stomach clenched. Something was pushing its way up. David stepped back, watching as yet another hand emerged, a woman's, followed by her other arm. Then, finally, her head erupted from the site, still half buried, her hair thick with dirt. Her mouth gaped open as if mid-scream, yet no sound escaped. David clamped a hand over his own mouth, stifling a gasp. The woman clawed her way free and rose from her grave. Her movements were not as stiff as Ken's. She was newer, fresher, but her eyes were just as clouded and empty. David felt sick. She took her time turning to Ken. He met her gaze, lowered his arms, and stopped chanting. Together, the two corpses stood in the moonlight in silence. Then, without a word, they turned and began to walk back to Ken's grave. David watched them go, rooted where he stood, fighting back the urge to vomit. Then, his body kicked into action. He had to know. He had to see. As Ken and the woman stepped back into his open grave, David forced himself forward. He crept to the edge of the disturbed soil, expecting to see a casket or a pit of loose dirt. But instead, he saw a staircase. The grave wasn't just a hole. The narrow passage was far too old, impossibly so, lined with stone, and it descended deep into the earth, far, far too deep. David took a couple of unsteady steps forward and tilted his flashlight down, shining it into the black, where the steps twisted out of sight. Down below, something moved, and the sound of wailing, of hundreds of screams woven together in a hellish cacophony, reverberated against the walls. David's throat clenched, and he shuddered involuntarily. His knees locked, and he stumbled back, clamping a hand over his mouth to keep quiet. He turned and ran. David barely remembered the drive back. His hands shook as they gripped the wheel. His foot pressed harder on the gas than it should have. The streets of Briarton were quiet and empty, but he wasn't looking at them. His mind was still in the graveyard, still at the edge of the pit. In his mind, he could still hear the wailing. It hadn't been one voice. It had been many. He pulled into the church parking lot and shut off the engine, but made no move to exit the vehicle. The image of Ken climbing out of his grave was burned into his mind, the way the woman had risen so easily, so naturally, the way they had both descended. He had gone down only a few steps, but he had felt it. Something was down there, something far worse than two walking corpses. A knock on his window nearly made him jump out of his skin. David gasped, instinctively jerking away before realizing that it was Elliot. Elliot Mercer, the drummer for the church band, stood outside the truck, peering in. He was dressed in a hoodie and ripped jeans, his long hair pulled back into a messy bun. His usual easy grin was absent.
"Take it easy, man," Elliot murmured as David rolled the window down. "You look like hell."
David swallowed, trying to steady his voice.
"What are you doing here?"
Elliot snorted.
"You texted me, remember?"
David blinked. Had he? He fumbled for his phone, scanning his last messages. He had, in fact, texted Elliot less than 20 minutes ago. "Meet me at the church." He barely remembered sending it. Elliot leaned on the truck door.
"What's going on, Dave? You sounded off."
David hesitated. Then, before he could stop himself, he said, "Ken Klein is alive." Elliot stared at him. Then he laughed.
"That's ridiculous."
David shook his head.
"I saw him. I saw him climb out of his grave.
He paused, trying to force his thoughts into words.
"It's not just him. There's someone else. Something else beneath the cemetery."
Elliot's expression shifted.
"Wait," he said. "You're serious?"
David nodded.
"I wouldn't be here if I wasn't."
Elliot rubbed his face.
"Okay," he said finally. "Tell me everything."
30 minutes later, they sat in David's office, the overhead light buzzing faintly. David recounted everything. The stories, the grave disturbances, Ken's resurrection, the woman, and the staircase. He left nothing out. Elliot listened, arms crossed, his fingers tapping against his bicep. When David finished, silence stretched between them. Then Elliot let out a long sigh.
"I should tell you you're full of it," he said.
"But you won't," David said. Elliot grunted.
"Because this town's weird as hell, and I've seen enough to know it. But man, do you hear yourself? You just told me you followed a dead guy to a grave that leads underground and heard...
what? Screaming?" "Wailing." "Wailing," Elliot repeated, rubbing his temples.
"And now what? You want to go back? Because I know that look. That's your 'I'm about to do something incredibly dumb' look."
"I need to know what's down there," David said.
Elliot stared at him like he had grown a second head.
"You already know. It's something that drags the dead back underground. What more do you need?"
David shook his head.
"It's more than that. Ken's not just wandering. He's bringing them back. The woman, who was she? Why her? And that staircase. Someone built it. Someone carved it. It's been there."
Elliot didn't answer. David pressed on.
"I'm going back, but I don't want to go alone."
Elliot tapped his fingers faster, and he groaned.
"I can't let you go down there alone,"
he muttered. Not because I think you'll find anything, but because I think you'll get stuck or break a leg, and then I'll have to explain to the congregation why our pastor is dead in a hole and I didn't do anything to prevent it.
David almost smiled. So you'll come?
Elliot gave him a long, suffering look, then shoved his chair back.
Fine, but I swear if I see one dead guy start talking, I'm getting the heck out of there.
Part 3. The cemetery was colder than before. David hadn't expected that. The night air had been mild when they left the church, but as he and Elliot climbed the hill toward Ken's grave, a distinct chill settled in the air. It wasn't wind. The trees weren't moving.
Jesus, Elliot muttered, rubbing his arms. Did the temperature just drop, or is my body trying to warn me to get out of here?
David didn't answer. He felt it too. They got to the edge of the disturbed grave, where the earth remained piled up as it had been. Elliot whistled low under his breath.
I was kind of hoping this would look normal when we got here, he admitted.
David aimed his flashlight down into the black void. The stairs were still there. Elliot leaned over the edge, his expression hard to read.
I hate to say it, but I think this means you weren't hallucinating.
David didn't need confirmation. He knew what he had seen, but that didn't mean he wanted to go down there again. Elliot adjusted the strap of his duffel bag. He had come prepared, bringing along ropes, an extra flashlight, and a crowbar. David had simply brought his Bible. Elliot noticed and grinned.
You planning on hitting zombies with that?
David ignored him and stepped forward. The moment his foot touched the first stone step, the wailing began again. Both men froze. It was distant, but no less awful. Hundreds of voices, crying out, stitched together in a din that made David's stomach lurch. Elliot said softly,
Yeah, no, this is bad. I've seen enough horror movies to know that when you hear the voices of the damned, you go in the opposite direction.
David swallowed hard, ignored him, and kept moving. He stepped onto the second step, and then the third. The wailing didn't stop. Elliot followed, muttering under his breath,
You are going to owe me a beer for this.
The stairs twisted down in a slow, spiraling descent. The walls around them were a mixture of packed dirt and hewn stone, lined with symbols. David ran a hand over them as he passed.
Recognize any of this? Elliot asked.
David shook his head.
It's not Hebrew or Latin, not anything I know.
Elliot let out a dry chuckle.
Great. That's just great.
The wailing grew louder. The deeper they went, the more wrong it felt. And yet, they kept going. Finally, after what felt like forever, the stairs leveled out and they found themselves standing at the mouth of a vast underground tunnel. The dirt walls stretched high above them, arched as if built by something long gone. The tunnel ahead was too dark to see the end, and the wailing was close. Elliot shifted beside him.
I don't like this, Dave.
David's throat was dry. Neither do I. But they had come this far. David wasn't about to turn back. Further ahead, in the darkness, something shuffled. They weren't alone. They strained their ears. It wasn't the sound of one. It was the sound of many. David lifted his flashlight.
Elliot grabbed his wrist. No,
he protested. David hesitated. Elliot's voice was strained.
We already know what's down here.
David turned the light away. For a moment, there was nothing but a tunnel of dirt and stone. And then, the shapes began to shift. There, in the darkness, dozens of figures stood, lying in wait. The moment the light caught their faces, David felt the breath leave his body. These were not corpses, nor were they alive. They were something else entirely. The wailing stopped, and the sound of approaching footsteps rose. Something was coming. David's flashlight flickered. Elliot grabbed his sleeve.
We need to go, now!
David didn't argue. Together, they ran, and neither man looked back. The tunnel sloped upward, the dirt slick beneath his feet. David could hear Elliot breathing hard beside him, his footsteps pounding against the uneven ground. Behind them, the footsteps multiplied, a chorus of movement. David's flashlight flickered again. The light was dying.
Move!
Elliot shoved him forward. The tunnel twisted to the left. They nearly slammed into the wall before scrambling around the bend. The wailing had stopped, but the footsteps had not. They were being followed, and whatever it was that was chasing them was getting closer. David tried to focus. He counted the steps in his head, trying to remember how far down they had come. 200 feet? 300? The staircase should have been close. He felt it before he saw it. The air changed, the pressure shifting as they neared the stairs.
There!
David gasped. The entrance was just ahead. And then Elliot cried out. David's stomach plummeted. Elliot had stumbled. His foot snagged on something. Something that reached out from the dirt. David turned just in time to see a hand gripping Elliot's ankle. Not a rotting hand. A hand that looked almost human, except for the length of the fingers and the way it moved and squeezed. Elliot kicked wildly.
Get it off me!
He screamed. David lunged, swinging the flashlight down hard and smashing it against the thing's wrist. The impact sent a crack through the tunnel. The fingers loosened, and Elliot yanked free. David grabbed his arm and hauled him up, and they ran. Up ahead, the staircase loomed. David's chest ached and his legs burned. Behind him, he could hear the movement, faster now, growing more frantic. They hit the stairs at full speed.
Up, up, he thought. Don't stop!
The wailing began again. The tunnel shook, and David felt the dirt walls shudder. An inhuman groaning sound rose beneath them. The earth itself was moving. They burst from the grave. David hit the ground hard, sprawling in the damp grass. Elliot landed beside him, gasping. For a moment, nothing happened. Then, a hand gripped the edge of the grave, and another. And then, Ken Klein's face emerged, his eyes locked onto David's. David scrambled backward. Ken did not follow. He simply stared. Then, without a sound, he climbed back down. The earth closed over him, and the grave sealed itself shut. Elliot was the first to speak.
We're leaving, right now.
David couldn't argue. They ran from the cemetery, not looking back. And in the silence that followed, the residents of Briarton slept on, unaware of what had almost followed them back. David sat in his office at the church, staring at the grainy, black-and-white footage on his laptop. The cemetery's security camera had been a last-minute thought. After his first vigil at Ken Klein's grave, he had asked Jack Henshaw, the gravekeeper, if there were any working cameras in the area. Jack had grumbled about budget cuts, but eventually pointed him toward an old, half-forgotten unit mounted on the north fence line. David had pulled the footage that morning. Now, watching it frame by frame, he wished he hadn't. He adjusted the playback speed, slowing it down, watching the moment that Ken emerged. It was worse on video. The low resolution somehow made it more unnatural. The way Ken's hand punched through the soil, the way his body rose from the grave in jerking, impossible movements, as though he were a puppet being yanked upward by invisible strings. David skipped ahead in the footage, watching himself appear on screen, following Ken into the dark, then Elliot. Then, at 4:12 a.m., the feed cut out. The last frame was of the grave, sealed shut. David leaned back in his chair, rubbing his hands over his face. There was no evidence of what had chased them, no sign of the figures in the tunnel. As far as the camera was concerned, Ken had simply climbed back into his grave, and nothing had happened. The door to his office swung open. Elliot stood in the doorway, arms crossed, his expression grim.
Tell me you're not still thinking about going back, Elliot barked.
David hesitated, prompting Elliot to shut the door behind him.
Come on, Dave, you're obsessed.
David sighed, tilting the laptop screen toward him.
Look at this,
Elliot reluctantly stepped forward. He watched the footage in silence. Then, after a long pause, he said,
"So, what? The camera glitched?"
David shook his head. "No, something didn't want to be seen." Elliot frowned.
"What do you think's down there?"
David hesitated.
"I don't know."
It wasn't entirely true. Something had been waiting, something ancient and hungry. Elliot ran a hand through his hair.
"So, what's the plan?"
David had been thinking about that all night. "We seal the grave," he replied. Elliot blinked.
"With what?"
"Cement, brick, anything that'll hold." Elliot let out a dry laugh.
"And you think that's gonna stop whatever's down there?"
David's jaw tightened.
"It has to."
For a moment, Elliot just stared at him.
"Fine," he said. "Let's do it."
4 hours later, they stood at Ken's grave. They had brought concrete mix, a trowel, and heavy stones. Jack Henshaw had grudgingly agreed to let them do it, though he hadn't asked any questions. David stepped to the edge of the grave, gripping the bag of cement. Elliot hovered beside him, arms crossed.
"You think it's watching us?"
David didn't answer. They worked in silence. They filled the grave, poured the cement, and set the stones. By the time they finished sealing the burial site, the afternoon sun hung high. For the first time since this had started, David felt relieved. Elliot dusted his hands off.
"So, that's it?"
David nodded.
"That's it."
They packed up their tools and left the cemetery. That night, David slept without nightmares. That night, the town was quiet, and for the first time in 2 weeks, Ken's grave remained undisturbed. Part 4. David woke to the sound of his phone ringing. He squinted at the screen. Jack Henshaw. His stomach tightened.
"No," he thought.
He answered. Jack's voice came through, gravel rough and shaking.
"You need to get down here."
David sat up too fast, his head spinning.
"What happened?" "It's the grave."
David was already reaching for his keys. The cemetery was quiet when he arrived. Elliot was already there, standing near the far edge of the graveyard. His hands were shoved in his pockets, his face tight. Jack stood near Ken's grave, looking pale and drawn. David didn't want to look, but he had to. The cement was cracked. The stones had shifted. The grave was disturbed again. Elliot let out a slow, bitter laugh.
"So much for our plan."
David swallowed hard. He took a shaky step forward, crouching beside the grave. The cement had broken from the inside. It wasn't cracked from above or tampered with. Something had pushed through and crawled out. David pressed a hand to the dirt. It was cold and damp, and beneath the surface, he could still feel it. The faintest shift, a whisper of movement. The thing beneath was still there, waiting. Jack cleared his throat.
"I don't think it wants to stay buried, boys."
David grimaced. Elliot shook his head.
"So, what now?"
David looked down at the grave, at the ruined cement and the earth that refused to stay still. He had no answer. It wasn't just Ken, he realized. It never had been. Something beneath Briarton had been waiting for a long, long time. And it was awake. David woke the next morning to the sound of his phone ringing again. He peered at the screen. His heart sank when he realized that, once again, it was Jack Henshaw. He answered, and Jack's voice came through, low and gravelly.
"It's not just Ken's grave anymore."
David sat upright.
"What?" "There's more of them," Jack said,
his voice trembling.
"Roe plot, Devereaux family lot, old Whitley tomb, graves all over the cemetery. They're all open, every last one. I already called the sheriff, but I figured you needed to know."
David was already pulling on his pants before the call ended. By the time he arrived at St. Matthias, Elliot was already there, standing at the gates, pale and wide-eyed.
"It's bad, Dave," Elliot muttered, waving him forward. "It's so bad. I think we may need to go with Plan B. Did you bring everything?"
David nodded. "I have the supplies, but let's hope it doesn't come to that."
"I'm scared, Dave," Elliot said.
"Me too, Elliot. Me too." They crossed the grass in silence. The cemetery was in ruins. Graves weren't simply dug up, they were torn apart. Headstones were shattered. Vault lids had been split clean in half. Some holes had collapsed inward, while others looked as though something enormous had pushed its way out. And in every instance, there were no bodies, only holes.
"It's like something came up," Elliot said, his voice low, "and then moved on."
David's mouth was dry. How many graves were opened? Jack stood nearby, clutching a thermos with trembling hands.
24, at least, that we found so far.
Elliot swallowed.
"You think they all got out?"
David didn't respond. Just then, a deputy came running up the hill, panting and pale.
"Same thing over at Calvary Hill," he said. "And the mausoleums by the Lutheran chapel. Reports from the east side, too. It's not just here. It's everywhere. Every graveyard's been hit. All last night."
David stared out at the ruined burial plots. The wind stirred the grass around the broken stones. And then he heard it. Chanting. Deep and inhuman, rising from somewhere deep beneath the earth. They all heard it. Jack's thermos slipped from his fingers, and then the ground beneath Ken's grave buckled. A soft, groaning sound rolled up through the dirt, followed by a vibration David could feel in the soles of his feet. And something rose. Not Ken Klein or his mysterious partner, but something enormous and hideous. It had no eyes or face. Its skin was grotesque and stretched, like it had once worn flesh, but no longer needed to. And yet it moved effortlessly, as though gravity didn't apply to it the same way. Ken and the woman emerged on either side of it, walking with quiet precision. Their skin was intact. Their eyes were clear. They were no longer undead, but imbued with the supernatural vigor of unknown origins. David turned to Elliot. "We have to collapse the main corridor. Now."
"Plan B?" Elliot asked,
his face twisting in shock. David nodded. He had come prepared. Elliot ran to the truck and grabbed the canvas bag from the back. Inside were the demolition charges, the last resort they had sworn not to use unless there was no other option. Together, they placed the charges around the mouth of Ken's grave, but when David looked inside, he realized it was already too late. The stairs didn't spiral down anymore. A few steps down, they crumbled and descended not into a tunnel or corridor, but into an endless black expanse, an abyss stretching into eternity. Far, far below, seemingly miles away, David spotted a faint light pulsing in the dark. Breathing. David and Elliot cast a glance at one another, and then back at the useless detonator. The expressions on their faces said it all. Elliot sank to his knees and buried his face in his hands. David prayed. Then the power went out, not just at the cemetery, but everywhere. The streetlights downtown flickered, then died. The church lights, visible from the hill, went dark. David's phone vibrated once and went black. Elliot checked his. Same. Above them all, a strange hue bled across the sky. Red at first, then grayish green, like the world was bruising. In the distance, at the edge of town, more graves cracked open. In the far woods behind the chapel, earth shifted. David stood at the summit of the hill and watched as more and more plots gave way. Calvary Hill, Whisper Pines, Lutheran Memorial. Something beneath the town had indeed woken up, and they were no longer rising one by one. They were coming all at once, and they weren't climbing to escape. They were paving the way. As David stood by, watching helplessly, Bible in hand, wave after wave of bodies poured from the growing number of open graves, clambering from the yawning chasms, wailing in unison. In the distance, beyond the borders of the town he had called home for the past 8 years, the same haunting cries began to rise. The gate was open. It would not be closed. Of the end, Briarton was just the beginning. You've just heard Under Ken by Craig Groshek. Craig Groshek is the creator and operator of the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, which has grown to nearly 500,000 subscribers, over 3,000 uploads, and more than 69 million video views in its 12 years of operation. He also oversees production of 4 weekly audio horror fiction podcasts, faithfully adapting and featuring the work of thousands of indie horror authors. A published author himself, dozens of his short stories have been adapted for this channel and other platforms. He holds a bachelor's degree in communication from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. In his free time, Groshek enjoys a wide range of outdoor activities, traveling, and spending time with 3 horror-loving children and his friends. Geez, sometimes you just really feel like going outside and getting some fresh air. I think all of us have spent enough time underground for one night. But don't worry, listeners. I'm sure our journey will take us back to the abyss sometime soon. For now, I'll give my thanks to Micah Edwards and Craig Groshek for tonight's entertainment, and then I think I'm heading out to the porch for a while. Be sure to come back next week for more Horror Hill, and until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.